This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There are so many amazing acts of altruism that we commit. They're so overwhelming that we don't see them at all. And instead, what we see is the selfish acts that a few people commit. Our good nature has been thwarted. Our potential for being a really amazing species and doing really fantastic things has been stopped, and the psychopaths have come to the fore, Donald Trump being a rather good example.
When you think of the values emblematic of politics in the Occident, does the term altruism come to mind? Probably not lately. Our guest today on Sea Change Radio believes that a participatory culture with altruism at its core will be key to digging ourselves out of the mess that is our current political climate. This week we're speaking with one of the world's leading environmental voices, George Monbiot. Acclaimed author, journalist, and activist, Monbiot talks about his latest book, Out of the Wreckage, A New Politics in the Age of Crisis. He discusses what he sees as lessons from the 2016 U.S. presidential election, why a growth orientation on both right and left are incompatible with sustainability, and how we can infuse more altruism into our culture and politics. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by George Monbiot. He is an author, journalist, and political activist. George, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks very much, Alex.
It's really a pleasure to have you. I've been an admirer of your work for years now, and it's a real treat to speak with you. You have a new book entitled Out of the Wreckage. Why don't you first kind of give us the general thesis and what inspired you to write it?
Sure, thanks. Well, my previous book was called How Did We Get Into This Mess? So I suppose it was inevitable that I would have to write a book about how to get out of it. And so I took a lot of advice and did a lot of reading and a lot of thinking. And what I began to notice, well, was four things, really, four quite striking things. One, that it's not so much political leaders or political parties that change stuff. It's political narratives. It's big political stories. And if you look at the past 70 years or so, you'll see them as a clash between those two great stories of Keynesian social democracy and free market fundamentalism or neoliberalism. And when each was dominant, they just swept the board, the whole political board. Republicans became Keynesians as well as Democrats. Conservatives became Keynesians. Richard Nixon is alleged to have said, "We're all Keynesians now." It didn't matter where you came from, what your prior politics were, you just accepted it as the common sense. And then when Keynesianism ran into trouble in the late 1970s, the neoliberals, people like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, they swept in and said, "We've got this whole new story. Hey, this is a new common sense." And everybody fell into line within a few years. And the Democrats became neoliberals. Labour became neoliberal. And it was the big story which captured people's minds and changed everything. That was the first observation. The second one was I realised that both Keynesianism and neoliberalism, even though they are diametrically opposed to each other, have exactly the same narrative structure in the way that they present their story of change. And this structure is what I call the restoration story. And it goes like this. It says, "Disorder afflicts the land caused by the nefarious activities of a group of people working against the interests of humanity. The heroes of the story, who might be one person or a group of people or a large group or an institution, fight those nefarious forces, overthrow them, and restore order to the land." And when you, I might not have time to go into it all now, but when you look at the narrative structure which both of those two big ideas use, it is identical. And then that led to the third observation, which is that that narrative structure, that restoration story, is common to most successful political transformations and most religious revolutions as well. And then that led to the fourth observation, which is that the reason we're still stuck with neoliberalism, with this market fundamentalism, despite its manifest failures in the financial crash, the environmental crisis, the political crisis, the crisis of inequality, the reason it's still there is that we haven't replaced it with a new story. And the only thing which can displace a story is a story. You cannot take away someone's story without giving them a new one. If you do what Hillary Clinton did, which was to try to sort of fight the Republican story with just a stream of facts and figures and sort of try to logically spell things out, those just bounce off. Because what people look for when they try to make sense of the world is narrative sense. Does it hang together as we expect a story to do? Does it progress from A to B to C? Does the hero triumph in the end? They're looking for a story that makes sense of the world, and we are innately predisposed to that. We've got a very strong narrative instinct. So what we desperately need, if we are going to have a radical transformation of our prospects and are going to get through the 21st century despite all the many crises which currently confront us, is a brand new restoration story. And so what I set out to do in this book is to tell that story.
And I want to dive into some of the solutions that you set forth later on. But getting back to Hillary Clinton, you also lay it very much at the feet of her husband's presidency, Bill Clinton. His brand of moderatism was powerful and seductive, I guess, coming off of the Reagan years. But ultimately, it didn't have its own story. It was a mealy-mouthed, trying-to-please-all-sides form of policy, which you believe kind of lacked a narrative. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, well, what Bill Clinton did in the US and what Tony Blair did in the UK was successful in the short term and catastrophic in the long term. Because while it sort of worked in that it allowed them to maintain power largely by appeasing powerful interests so that they didn't get, they didn't have too many problems with Wall Street, too many problems with the media. In the long run, it destroyed the credibility of their parties and it destroyed their sort of narrative thrust. And what they were doing was triangulation. They said, right, okay, this is the Democrats' old position or Labour's old position, which is basically Keynesian social democracy. This is the Republican big corporate position, which is neoliberalism, market fundamentalism. We're going to take a bit of this and a bit of that, and we'll mix them up and create a third way. And that's what triangulation is. And their parties became lost in their Bermuda triangulation, where there was just no coherent narrative, no coherent story, and eventually no hope, because there was almost no difference between their politics and those of their opponents. The reason for that was, you know, you had on the one hand the dying star of Keynesian social democracy, and the other the massive gravitational pull of this new insurrectionary doctrine of neoliberalism. And there was just very clear which way that battle was going to go.
And people who followed the Clinton-Sanders primary closely may have been turned off by the seeming redundancy of Bernie Sanders' message. But you believe that that narrative is ultimately powerful and is the most effective way to get your message across and get elected.
I felt Sanders had a powerful message, and I feel that had he won the nomination, he would have won the presidency. I don't think Trump would have stood a chance against Sanders, because people were just desperately looking for someone who is actually talking about their problems and talking about real solutions to their problems, rather than a sort of just a sort of hesitant, third way, Wall Street oriented business as usual, which was basically what Hillary Clinton was promising. And, you know, Sanders was saying, you are hurting. I know why you're hurting. And let's do something about that, which was great. And you know, I would much rather have seen Sanders win that nomination. But there's still a problem, because just like with Jeremy Corbyn over here in the UK, what he was offering was really a 20th century story. He was going back to the Keynesian social democratic story, which, you know, in the 20th century was wonderful. It was amazing. And during what the French call the Trente Glorieuses between 1945 and 1975, the wonderful 30 years, it performed miracles. But there's several problems with Keynesianism. One, it ran into trouble in the 70s, and the reasons why it ran into trouble have not gone away: cost push, inflation, stagflation, and the rest of it. Two, big capital found a way of smashing it by ripping down capital controls and foreign exchange controls and thwarting the idea of an international clearing union and all the other elements which were essential to make Keynesianism work, and they will not have forgotten how to destroy it. But third, most importantly, it runs smack bang into the environmental crisis, because what it depends on is sustaining rates of economic growth. The whole idea of the Keynesian solution is stimulus spending, but pumping money into the economy in order to create employment through consumption. You put more money in people's pockets, they consume more, that creates employment. Hard to do without your capital controls and foreign exchange controls within your national borders, because the employment goes to China nowadays. But that's how the theory works. Well, if it does work, then what you're doing is committing us to perpetual economic growth, which commits us to environmental ruin. And we're seeing that at the moment. I mean, basically, the environmental breakdown, which is taking place on just about all fronts at the moment, is because we have an economy that's growing and growing and growing on a planet that is not growing. And infinite growth on a finite planet is bound to end in tears. And that's where it's heading very rapidly at the moment, with climate breakdown, with breakdown of the ocean ecosystems, with the massive clearing of forests, of wetlands, of magnificent places all over the planet, with air pollution, with so many ills that it's causing at the moment. And that's basically being driven by a system that depends on perpetual growth. And both neoliberalism and Keynesianism depend on perpetual growth. So that 20th century solution simply will not do in the 21st. And what we need to hear now from the more radical Democrats, like Sanders, and from Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party here and others, is a new story. You know, they've been really good at creating space, political space, which wasn't there before, and bringing things to the table which weren't on the table before. But now we need to hear a new story. And that's what I'm trying to do in the book, is to spell out what that new story might be. And I'm not claiming to have a monopoly on the truth, but, you know, here's my proposal for how we could do it.
So we've touched upon how neoliberalism and Keynesianism have not been good for those who care about the planet with its thirst for endless growth. But let's focus just for a second, though, on neoliberalism and its worship of the free market. How has it been able to kind of pull one over the world in terms of the worship of the free market juxtaposed by clean energy, which makes so much sense in both a capitalist sense, long term at least, and those who care about clean air and clean water? How have they been able to kind of wipe that slate clean for so many people? It seems the roots are deeper than just a political message.
Well, what neoliberalism has done is to cause crises on just about all fronts. I mean, it has greatly exacerbated the environmental crisis. It's sort of capitalism on steroids, which has, because what it says is there should be no restraint upon very rich people. They should be able to do what they want. They should not be constrained by regulation, by taxation, by democracy, by trade unions. So they should be allowed to let rip. And that's had devastating environmental consequences, but it's also had devastating social consequences: massive inequality, job insecurity, huge health issues and safety issues for workers and for consumers. It's had massive political consequences, because it's shut down choice. I mean, what it says is, we're not going to do this through politics anymore. We're not going to do it through democracy, through voting. Everything's going to be done through the market. And you will exercise your choice through buying and selling. And people will vote by that means. Of course, what that means is that some people have more votes than others because they have more money. They have more power within the market than other people do. But that's part of their approach. But it's not just that, you know, we're going to replace democracy with the market. We're going to basically redefine human life by the market. And you're going to be defined as consumers or as producers. And your relationships are going to be transactional relationships. And never mind all this community stuff and never mind all this mutual aid thing. You're just going to try and make as much money from other people as possible. And what that's going to do is create a class of extremely rich people, and their wealth is then going to trickle down to enrich everyone. That's how the theory goes. And it has been catastrophic. It was the deregulation of the financial sector, which neoliberals like Alan Greenspan insisted on, which led to the financial crash. It's the deregulation of the fossil fuel industry, which has been allowed to carry on smashing and grabbing, which has led to climate breakdown. It's the stopping, the prevention of sort of the distribution of wealth through taxation, which has led to this massive crisis of inequality and the effective collapse of many public services. So it's been a sort of full spectrum assault on human interests, but it's not enough just to say that. And it's not enough to point out what's wrong with it. What we need is a new story.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to George Monbiot. He is an author, journalist, political activist, and environmentalist. One thing that I didn't really read in your book, Out of the Wreckage, was the seductive nature of neoliberalism. The trickle-down economics gets to a mass audience in a very powerful way, in a magical thinking kind of way, saying, if we can somehow get government out of the system and cut your taxes, everything will grow and the market will be blossoming. And that's a very powerful message that I think has been fed for multiple decades now. It's so simple. I'm wondering if the lack of funding for good public education and creating this fear of liberalism, liberal elitism, has kind of intersected with this trickle-down message.
Well, what we've seen has been a highly effective and persuasive pattern of storytelling by the neoliberals, who have managed to present their proposals as common sense, and people have widely accepted it and internalized it and reproduced it with quite devastating consequences often for our mental health. There's a very interesting book by Paul Verhage, a Belgian psychoanalyst, called What About Me, which looks at how our internalization of the neoliberal message has had devastating consequences in terms of anxiety disorders, social phobias, self-harm, eating disorders, because we basically have been induced to see ourselves as individuals, as basically to see ourselves as no longer being part of a community, part of society, but as having to fight like stray dogs over a dustbin, and to see this as a good thing. You know, we have a whole inspiring lexicon which is supposed to validate and valorize the idea of being alone. Lone ranger, sole trader, self-made man and woman. You know, we don't talk about people anymore, we say individuals. And individuals walking down the street. We can't complete a sentence without using the word personal. Personally speaking, to distinguish myself from a ventriloquist dummy, I prefer personal friends to the impersonal variety, and personal belongings to the belongings which don't actually belong to me. You know, we use this redundant word all the time because we are induced to imagine that we are completely alone and that we are supposed to be alone and that we're supposed to be intensely individualistic and intensely competitive. But actually, that's not how we are at all.
Something like organized religion, where it's such community focused, but we've now created this personal relationship with Jesus.
Yes, that is very symptomatic of it. In fact, you know, that instead of something we do together, we're now doing this by ourselves. And there's a whole load of ways in which we're doing that, you know, and of course this knits in with technology, because now instead of going to the cinema, we watch something at home. Instead of taking the train or the bus, we are all driving in our cars. When we get to work, instead of having the same colleagues every day, we're hot desking, we might be on 0 hours contracts, there's a constant turnover of staff, everybody's precarious and insecure. So you don't have that collegiate thing at work either. But that is coupled with this virulent ideology of extreme individualism and of everyone competing in a market, which is what neoliberalism is all about, which has really captured our minds. We've really come to believe that. And yet we really are not like that. And this takes me to the story that I'm trying to tell. Over the past 20 years or so, there's been a remarkable convergence of findings in a whole load of different disciplines, in neuroscience, in psychology, in anthropology, in evolutionary biology. And they all point to the same extraordinary finding, that we are, by comparison to any other animal species, spectacularly altruistic, really amazingly altruistic. If we saw the sort of daily humdrum acts of altruism that we commit in any other species, we would be absolutely amazed to see it. But we're so used to it, to sort of, you know, helping people with their baggage, giving money to a cause which has nothing to do with us, volunteering for something where we get no material gain from it, looking after a sick friend or a sick relative or an elderly person. There are so many amazing acts of altruism that we commit. They're so overwhelming that we don't see them at all. And instead, what we see is the selfish acts that a few people commit. So, you know, we think back, for instance, to the Charlie Hebdo massacre, where those two horrible people, the terrorists in Paris, killed 12 people in cold blood. And we think, gosh, aren't human beings terrible? Look what they did. You know, that's us. That's what we're like. We forget the fact that 3.7 million people came out onto the streets of France in solidarity with the victims. And that around the world, millions more came onto the streets in solidarity. You know, in solidarity with people whose language we didn't even speak. You know, that is a human norm. Not those two terrorists, but all the millions of people who came out. That is what we're like. But we've been induced not to see this. And this is where the land has been thrown into disorder, because of this virulent ideology, this neoliberalism. Has said, no, we're not like that at all. Our natural role is to fight like stray dogs over a dustbin. As Thomas Hobbes says, we're engaged in a war of all against all. And the natural state of human life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And we've absorbed that and believed it. And so our good nature has been thwarted. Our potential for being a really amazing species and doing really fantastic things has been stopped. And the psychopaths have come to the fore, Donald Trump being a rather good example. And it's often the case that communities of really great people are ruled by psychopaths who then impose their craziness on everybody else. But we've allowed this to happen, and it's particularly likely to happen in a situation where we're totally misled about what human nature is. And so our task, we, the heroes of this story, is to recover our good nature, not to change human nature, to reveal human nature and to allow ourselves to become the amazing, altruistic, empathetic, cooperative people that we really are. And we do that by two means. One, by transforming community life, making it a rich and real proposition through what's called the participatory culture of loads of amazing community projects of the kind we're now seeing springing up in lots of parts of the world, coupled with communities having real control over their assets, over their surroundings, over the land that surrounds them, over their water, over their other crucial resources.
Yes, you talk about extending the commons, and I've heard of that, but I had never heard this term, which I really liked, was public luxuries. Maybe you could explain what that means.
Yes, well, you see, you know, in our cities and in most parts of the world, there is loads of space for us all to live in luxury if we live with public luxury. We can build fantastic parks. We can build wonderful amenities where we can all play great sports because there's enough amenities, where we can all have amazing entertainment. But if we try to do it all through private luxury, if everybody tries to have their own tennis court or their own huge home cinema or and their own sort of garden like a park, well, there's simply no room. There is not space to have functional cities, cities which don't sprawl all over the land and basically fall apart as a result, while everybody is seeking private luxury. But we can do it through public luxury. And combining that notion of public luxury with community control, where the community actually is in charge of what happens and receives through land value taxation significant income from those crucial resources, which it can then redistribute either as a basic income or by building those amenities, or it can buy land and start building social housing and whatever else is needed, then you start to make sense of community. But at the same time, you've got to operate at the government scale as well, and we need changes of government. And I think the sort of thing that Becky Bond and Zach Exley, who you've had on, are talking about with the big organizing model they used in the Sanders campaign has got enormous potential.
Yeah, it's ultimately a very hopeful message, I think. And one of the examples you use in the book spoke to me. You mentioned how there have been studies in places like San Francisco and Bristol, England, that show that streets that have more traffic tend to have less community connectedness. There's less of a community in a busy street. That makes sense. But if we could use that as an allegory for neoliberalism, which has been fighting tooth and nail to try to keep the welfare state, as it likes to refer to it as, from blossoming, try to make people work harder. That's our problem, is we're not working hard enough. But if you look at the allegory of moving so fast in this world of, you know, alienation and atomization, like these atoms are moving faster and faster while people have to be more productive, there's no time to slow down. There's no time to connect. There's no time to revive a community if you have to work three jobs and are a single mom with three kids. The happiness index is a much more humane way of, and ultimately a better long-term way of approaching a society than GDP.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right, of course. And yes, there's a good analogy to be made that, you know, while everybody's running around like a headless chicken, you can't embed community and you can't ensure that we create a better world for ourselves and for each other. And the traffic that fills our streets shuts down the community mind. It shuts down our sociability. It stops us operating together to confront questions that are bigger than we are, that we can only confront with other people. And so, yeah, it's quite a good analogy for the wider problem we face.
It's a terrific book called Out of the Wreckage. George Monbiot, thank you so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks very much, Alex. My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Cesaria Evora and The Clash. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.